Está a ouvir um podcast da Universidade do Porto.
Welcome to Library Talks, I3S University of Porto. Weekly, we'll meet researchers from all over the world. We'll know the stories behind the scientists and learn about their work in health science. Overloaded immune systems, neglected diseases, and a box full of surprises called Leishmania. In this podcast, we bring back our dive into the science of antimicrobial resistance with Mark Huillet.
So Mark, thank you very much for being here at Library Talks. Could you tell us to start from the beginning, what drew you into science?
Okay, well, this is a good question. Actually, I was by chance gifted at the elementary school and high school, understand biology, math, physics, chemistry. But that didn't mean that I knew what I wanted to do. And then I had a course in genetics. I said, wow, that's pretty cool. Maybe this would be of some interest. And then I had a course in organic chemistry, and I liked that also. So organic chemistry, genetics. So at the time, that was in the late 70s, people say, well, maybe biochemistry will combine both chemistry and biology. Then I took biochemistry and I liked it, but no, not overwhelming. And then I had a course. It was about antigenic variation in the African trypanosome. I mean, I didn't know anything about it, but I was flabbergasted by the beauty of it, by the mechanism by which this parasite will evade the host immune response just by changing its coat, by changing its surface. After infection, he was changing that. And the molecular mechanism by which that was happening was just marvelous. And I say, well, this is what I want to do. I didn't do that for my doctoral degree, but during my postdoc, I had the good fortune of working on antigenic variation in the African trypanosome.
You mentioned beauty. You mentioned the adjective marvelous. So could you be more specific? What was that beauty? Why did you see that beauty in that specific?
It was so complex.
The complexity.
But at the other end, it was so simple. So that's beauty, yes? To have something very simple that look complex, but can be easily explained by molecular mechanisms. And it made a lot of sense. So that's beauty. It's the complexity and the simplicity at the same time.
Okay, so now I have to ask, could you introduce us to that parasite? What's so special about it?
Okay, well, the Trypanosoma brucei, so this is the parasite, is sleeping sickness. So this is a parasite that you found in Africa mostly, and it's the tsetse fly that is the vector entering for blood feeding. They will bite a host. It can be a human. They will transmit the parasite, and the parasite, instead of hiding itself, will just stay in the blood and will change its surface coat with time. So when I had the good fortune of being accepted in the lab, was really a premier lab in antigenic variation in the African trypanosome, my project was to set up gene transfection. So that means to take DNA from a test tube and introduce it into the parasite. And so that was my project, and it was an easy project on paper, but we had to elaborate that.
That was the postdoc project.
Yes, it was the postdoc project.
And why did you skip it in the doctoral degree? Why didn't you work on it right
okay,
on the
so,
doctoral degree?
Well, when I had this class about antigenic variation in the African trypanosome, it was so interesting that I thought everybody on the planet was working on antigenic variation. So I was knocking at doors and, do you work on this? And I rapidly found out that this was not the case. Actually, I'm from Canada, and nobody was, well, there was a lab, but far away from home, that was working on with the African trypanosome. So since this molecular mechanism was about gene rearrangements, I found a lab that was working on gene rearrangements, but with antibiotic resistance in bacteria. And this is actually, it's funny because, you know, it's a circle that turns around. And now I work a lot on antibiotic resistance in bacteria also. But so I work both with parasites and with bacteria. But that was my PhD work. But I always had in mind that for my postdoc, I would do antigenic variation in the African trypanosome. So my job was to set up transfection. And there was a distant parasite, a distant cousin from the African trypanosome that was called Leishmania, which is actually endemic in Portugal. And this is transmitted by the sandfly. And they're very close, the trypanosome and Leishmania, but they're giving very different disease and so on. But this parasite, Leishmania, had the distinct advantage of having pieces of DNA that were not part of the chromosome. They were extra chromosomal, just like plasmid for bacteria that provide resistance. And the idea was to take those plasmids, to make them vectors, so with DNA, that you could introduce into the trypanosome. At the end, we didn't need to do this. But then I became intrigued by those plasmids in Leishmania that were possibly associated with drug resistance. So that was my hypothesis. I made that hypothesis, and finally I found an amazing thing was that on this plasmid, there was a protein or a gene coding for protein that was homologous or similar to the proteins that give multidrug resistance in cancer cells. So in parasite, you had the same type of protein that was giving multidrug resistance in cancer cells. So this started a completely new project, and this linked very much with my PhD work that was about antimicrobial resistance, but antibiotic. So now I had the expertise of my PhD working on antibiotic resistance that I was putting into parasites into Leishmania. And since then, so this was done in the late 80s, and since 1990, as an independent investigator in Quebec City, Canada, I've been working on antimicrobial resistance, mostly with parasite, mostly with Leishmania. But since about 15 years, I've came back to bacteria, which is a huge health challenge right now, antibiotic resistance in bacteria.
So how would you define this resistance? Because there must be patterns, both in the bacterial resistance, how it develops its resistance, and in parasites. So what's in common in those?
Well, the commonalities between parasite and bacteria is the mechanistic way of resisting. Yes, there's not a zillion ways a cell can resist. It can be reduce uptake of the drug. So, you know, you have importers, and whether bacteria or parasite, the molecules are different, but the mechanism is the same. They'll get less import. Or if the drug gets in, they will expulse the drug outside. So both parasites, both cancer cells, both bacteria can do that. They have to find a target within the cell, the drug. So, well, the target can be changed. And that's true for bacteria, that's true for parasites. So there's a lot of commonalities between those. Where there are differences is in the terms of transmission of the resistant factors. Bacteria has developed very clever way of transferring this information of DNA from one bacteria to another. This is called conjugation. So this is bacterial sex. So you have like contact between two bacteria, and there will be a transfer of DNA. So this is conjugation. You have transformation. This is how DNA was discovered as the genetic material with the pneumococci in the 40s. Is you take DNA of one streptococcus with a certain resistant factor, and if you take the DNA, you put it with another pneumococcus that is sensitive, this other pneumococcus will become resistant. So this is transformation, conjugation, and there's phages also. That's transduction that can, viruses that can transmit information. That we don't see with parasites, or we don't see with cancer cells. So in cancer cells, it's mostly a clonal event. So there's a clone that is resistant compared to the general population that is not. And when you have the drug pressure, well, this clone will expand, and will become dominant. So the emergence of resistance and the transmission of resistance is different between bacteria and eukaryotic cells, but the mechanistic principles are similar.
So your research at the moment is more on this is still on these mechanistics or on the drug development part? Because you said you enjoy more the mechanistic end.
Yes. So I would say that we still focus and aim on mechanistic understanding of how cells become resistant. But in this era also of applications, all the technology, all the approaches that we have developed now are being used for understanding mode of action and actually take a new molecule that you know that is active, but you don't know the target yet. So by applying the tools, understanding how this novel molecule and this bacteria or this parasite, how they interact together, how they become resistant, is helpful for drug development because you can find a molecule that is active with no target, and by studying resistance, you can find a drug target and then improve that molecule so that there's a good interaction between the target and the new molecule you're studying. So actually we do that also in the lab. And if you understand resistance, if you understand it, you can generate the tools to diagnose resistance. And actually we've done that quite successfully for bacteria, for instance, where we've developed tests that were at the time PCR based that are able to detect bacteria that are resistant to different class of antibiotics. And when you know that information rapidly, you can change therapy that is directed against that bacteria.
The problem is if it is not rapidly enough, because the bacteria and its resistance, they are quite creative, let's say. So it's this creativity somehow predictable from your part?
So there's a lot of creativity, but there's a limit to creativity also because it has to be compatible with life. And there are main resistance mechanisms that once they have emerged are being stabilized within the population. And I'll give you one example that I'm sure here also in Porto you have that issue in hospital. This is methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, MRSA in English. I'm not sure what's the acronym in Portuguese, but there's one gene that is very important that needs to be detected. And there are assays now that I did contribute in the development of those assays that can say when you arrive at the hospital, there's a nasal swab, and in less than 1 hour, we can tell you whether you're a carrier or not. That doesn't mean that you're sick about this, but that you're a carrier and you have the possibility of transmitting that to others. So they may isolate you. And actually there's pharmacoeconomic studies that look at, okay, there's a cost to the test, but are you saving money because you're preventing transmission of infections to other very sick people that could, you know, be impacted by that disease?
How close do you work with pharmaceuticals?
Sorry?
How close do you work with pharmaceuticals?
Well, with parasites, I mean, there's not that much activity between the... But I shouldn't say that, because there are arms of even big pharmas that are more open source, that you know, wants to do co-development, because we do understand that we live in one world and that there needs to be development against those neglected tropical disease. Actually, at the last two G7 meeting, there was discussion about how do we move forward with those neglected tropical diseases that still touch the poorest of our of the world, and how can we contribute to development. And basically, in some of the work that I do collaborate with big pharmas where they provide openly the structure, the activity of molecules, and my task is to find the drug targets using my tools. And once we have drug target interactions, we can help in further developing those drugs. So those interactions are quite productive and interesting, because the common goal is to try to bring molecules closer to for okay. therapy.
So you don't have this vision of pharmaceuticals as the villain for scientists?
No. they are not. And of course, they have shareholders, and they have to arrive at a certain point to a profit. But I think the overarching goal, if it is not, the company will not be successful, is for the good of humanities. And you need the big pharma for all those clinical studies, so to ensure that the drugs are safe, the drugs do not have undue effect. And these are very expensive, and even public people would have difficulties. There are areas where I think public has to be involved and has to be able to find co-solutions with the big pharma for the good of society, because the profit may not be there, but it's good for the whole society. And then there can be co-investment between public and...
In this last area that you mentioned, we could mention the parasites, especially of this. There are certain diseases that are under-researched. Why do you think is that?
That
under research of those, that lack of research of those, it's mostly parasitic diseases.
Yes, I mean, it's a neglected tropical disease, so, you know, there are very trendy areas right now. Neuroscience, I think, is you know, in most big universities, there's a very strong component, and rightly so. I mean, we are an aging society, at least in the Western world, but that's true also for the low and middle income countries, where, you know, age expectation is increasing, and with age expectation, there's a lot of neurological and mental type of disease that are emerging, and I think having research in those areas is very important. And, you know, we know very little about brain yet. So this is important. So this is, you know, if there's more people working there, there will be less people working with parasite. But that doesn't mean that they, you know, in a university, there has to be diversity, and there has to be issues. Of course, the individuals need to like that. But so I think there will always be a place for parasitology, and it depends on the trend of, you know, for instance, nobody was, there were few people working on hemorrhagic type of viruses. And then with Ebola, there was a lot of activity. A lot of people just became Ebola expert while they had never worked on Ebola, but they work on viruses that were similar to Ebola, and, you know, applying their knowledge to Ebola, and, you know, there was a burst activity. Same thing with Zika that happened afterwards. You know, few were working really on those viruses, but they are viruses that are similar that, you know, bring activity. So there has to be also, as researcher, a certain kind of adaptation to respond to public needs, to respond to societal needs. And parasites are still big killers in the world, and some were less in contact with, but, you know, everybody knows somebody that either had malaria or had to take prophylaxis to prevent against malaria. So this is common knowledge. Leishmania here in Southern Europe is known. It's a veterinary disease also. So the best companion, the dogs, are often infected, but it's also a human issue in, you know, especially the immunodeficient individual, where they can be an issue there.
My question is more in the sense that how do you, from your experience, from your research path, how do you think those trends in science or in research, how they are brought up, how they emerge? It's from the scientists, it's from the political or social drivers.
Well, yeah. So there's I think it's a mixed of this. There's a lot of the great discoveries in the world have been from bottom up. So it's, you work on something with an objective, finally the results will bring you into another direction and maybe to groundbreaking discoveries. I think one of the great examples right now is the CRISPR-Cas system that now allows gene editing in human cells at a speed that nobody has thought of. But this was lactic bacteria and, you know, the production of yogurt that people were looking at until they've discovered those systems. The CRISPR-Cas system was a immunity against phages, and you know, and then this basic discovery led to this gene editing. So we have to get this bottom-up approach, and now the percentage of what it should be, that every researcher will have a different idea of the percentage of how much of this bottom-up approach, but this is innovation. This is the key to the research enterprise. But there are times, like I discuss about Ebola, Zika, but HIV in the 80s, I mean, there are times that we need to respond to those crises. If there's already capacity, well, redirect the capacity towards those needs, or if there's no capacity, well, to create the capacity to be able to try to respond. And this is the role of a government to say, well, wait a second, we need evidence for this or this, and let's create capacity for research in this area. And this is what we call targeted or strategic. And at other times it will be, okay, how can we bring this wonderful discovery from the lab closer to applications? So then linkage between academic labs and industry or with engineers to try to bring a product together. And again, you need special call that will go there because this may not be the bottom-up approach that is normally used. So we have to use a combination. And again, as I said, everybody will have
a share,
an idea of what should be the right percentage, and possibly there's no right answer to this because it depends also on the situation. But the critical, important point is to have this innovation from the bottom-up approach. So it's the investigator that have an idea, and practice shows that often it brings you into other directions, and this is where all the great discoveries are being made.
Mm-hmm. But the way the science is done has been changing, even with those crises that you've mentioned. So do you think that nowadays the conditions, the basic conditions and environment on institutional terms or others are reunited so that we can have those, that basic discoveries, that basic innovation from bottom up? Or do you think scientists, on the other hand, are being too pressured, publish or perish, and all those science policies that have been popping up, and sometimes they are a little bit noisy for the work itself?
So I hear what you're saying, but publish or perish, I think, has been there since science has started, yes, because it's a privilege to do fundamental research because, you know, it is with public money that you move forward ideas and try to bring it for, at the end, applications that will help the world, whether it's technology, whether it's health, whether it doesn't matter, but it's a privilege to do this. But in exchange of that privilege, there's competition. You have to produce, you have to show that your ideas have a tangible result. And the tangible result sometimes can be negative. That's important. And this is a place where we have to do better so that the world know about, okay, I had this idea, finally it doesn't work, so don't repeat that. It doesn't work. Well, you may want to repeat it once, just in case there was an issue. But so it's okay. But of course, you cannot only have negative results because at one point your peers will say, "Yeah, okay, but maybe your hypotheses are too far-fetched, or maybe you're too in front of your time." But you need to increase knowledge. Sometimes it's incremental, and once in a while, whoops, there's a quantum leap in the understanding of a phenomenon. So I think this principle is still the same than it used to be. of course, now generating data is not the same now as it used to be. It was the limiting factor, really, generating the data. Like, even when I started, generating data was demanding. And because it was a long process, well, you had the time to think about it, to already understand how it was going. Now generating data can be very rapidly, very, 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 very fast. And now the bottleneck is more in the interpretation of those data and the analysis of those data. And those data, you will always analyze them with one angle, but there are other angles that can be looked at. And maybe this is not your interest, but can be the interest of others. So this is why I tell all my students now and postdocs, well, I think you really have to develop your skills in analyzing data. And because the question you've asked, possibly the answer is somewhere in the cloud somewhere. And you have to understand how to get that information, which is not trivial. But also, once you have that, to try to find the information you want, because likely the experiment was not set up the way you would have set up, but the answer to it is probably there nonetheless, if you know how to do this. Mm-hmm. And I think this is going to be a transformation. Actually, there are groups now that this is what they do. Mm-hmm. They are just looking at public database and things like that and trying to understand other types of questions or other angles to a question that was asked, and some are very successful at it. So this has been a game changer. Also, now you need multiple facets, and you cannot be expert in everything. So collaboration, which was also, we were also collaborating a lot in the past, but now this is even more and more present right now, because a single lab has, can make some nice stories, but at one point, you need the expertise of others to move forward. And this explains why often some of the big papers, the big journals, have multiple authors, because it's just like physics right now, where you have to read many pages before you arrive to the article per se, because of all the authors that are present, because you need the skill sets, you need the power of many, and you need the precision now in physics that maybe you didn't need at a time, and that requires a apparatus that are just like amazing. So there have been changes, but the principle is similar. And you still see like two author papers again in big journals that are really just not incremental, but are changing our understanding of phenomena. So again, yes, things have changed. Technology is helping a lot, but the underlying principle of research is not that much different.
And one of the underlying principles of science is asking a good question. What is a good question for you in science?
Well, I mean, again, if I had the magical answer, I would always hit home runs every time I ask the question. But you have to be passionate about an issue, and you have to say, okay, how is this happening? How is, for instance, and I'll give one example, which has been, and this is an exception, because usually I ask questions and we don't get we get an answer, but that's not necessarily the answer we were expecting. But for one project, that was a very nice project, every time I asked the question and the people were performing the experiment, it did work. It was so wonderful. So in the parasite Leishmania, they resist drugs by these extra chromosomal pieces that I was talking about that resemble plasmids. And then we discovered that how they generate those circles or those extra chromosomal elements was through recombination through repeated sequences. And this, there were like number of species, number of examples where it was always repeated sequences. So I asked the question, gee, are those repeated sequences like specific to a region that is important for drug resistance, or is it like more frequent and it's present elsewhere? So I didn't know how to handle that, but I had a bioinformatic collaborator that I asked, okay, I'm a repeated sequences. I don't know who I am, but am I elsewhere? So it was a little bit of philosophy, yes? You say, oh, it's easy. You just take the sequence and you bless it. I said, oh, I don't need a collaborator to be able to do that because I don't know who I am. I said, oh, that's easy also. So and this is where collaboration is, because me, I didn't thought it was easy. And then it just turned out that the Leishmania genome is full of those repeated sequences, but they were missed, or at least they were not reported on, because they're pretty unique. So if I'm A elsewhere, but that's it. There's only two A. And then if there's B and B, well, there's only two B, and C and D and so on. So then there's thousands of those, but they're not like A and many, many, many copies of A's, because that people would have detected. But now it's AA. But AA will recombine together. BB will recombine together. And then I said, wow, this is amazing. And then we had a number of other questions about what, and that, then I needed a collaborator on DNA recombination, which, you know, I knew a little bit about it, but not the enzymes and things like that. And the collaborator said, well, this is going to require enzyme A or B, and this will require enzyme W. And he was right. And so, but it's really the observation that there were extra chromosomal elements, there were repeats that led to that question. And, you know, a very nice principle where this parasite, this is how he respond to an environment. So you have the population with the core genome, and then every cell has a little piece of DNA that is different. And it happens all the time. Yeah, it's not like because you put a drug that this is happening. The drug just select for that event. The event is there, but it's just like 1 out of 10^8 cells, so you will not detect it. But when you put a drug or you change the environment, then this subpopulation will emerge. Yeah, it's a clonal event that will emerge and it will come more and more important. The more you put drug, the more dominant it will come. You remove the drug, now the population will come back like this. So this is one of the mechanisms by which this parasite respond to change in environment. And this was true simple questions. Oh, there are repeated sequences. Is there now other repeated sequences elsewhere? So this is one example where the question I asked was the right one.
Back to your work, you're here in Porto to give us a talk here at I3S. Could you give us a brief overview of your talk today?
Okay. So as I indicated, all my career has been about understanding the mechanism of antimicrobial resistance. What I'll present today is more related to the parasite Leishmania. And the approach has been either to look at clinical isolates that were resistant. For Leishmania, there's only one drug where really there's an issue, because the other drugs are just recently introduced, although now we see already that some are working less well than they use when we start using them, so possibly explaining that there's emergence there. But for a class of drug, there's clear issues of resistance, so we sequence them, we analyze them, and we try to find the mutations. But when there's no clinical resistance, we select for resistance in the lab, and it works very well, but it's a very long process. Sometimes it takes up to a year to get a resistant mutant. So I try to say, okay, let's find ways to accelerate this. And now we're using a lot of genomic screens. And these are helpful because for us it's easy, because we select with a drug. Yes, we're interested in drug resistance. So we do a lot of screens. And What I'll present is some of the more recent innovative screens that we have developed to understand better and resistance and drug targets. And with the technology that has been developed, now the rate of discovery is really unprecedented, both in terms of quantity of markers and in terms of the depth in which you're able to look at that. But at the end, when you have those, it's business as usual. You have to characterize, you have to study them, and that's a long process as it is before. But what my main point here will be about those new innovative approaches to accelerate the discovery of resistant mechanisms and drug targets.
So those are, in your opinion, one of the biggest challenges in your work, in your field at the moment?
For me personally, yes, it's about finding new drugs against the parasite Leishmania or against multi-drug resistant bacteria. So this is my interest. I mean, but there are many challenges with neglected tropical disease, and I think it's a multi-prone approach that we'll be able to because if you always develop new drugs, at one point there will be resistance. So it's a continuous arm race. So there has to be other approaches also that are being used to be able to tackle such big and huge societal issues. Like AMR, antimicrobial resistance, is an issue not only in health, it's a one health approach. So it's agriculture, it's, you know, 75% of the antibiotics are being used in the agriculture field. But it's also the environment, because whether it's human that, you know, take antibiotics, go to the bathroom, flush the toilet, the antibiotics go in the environment. Same thing in agriculture. So it's the environment, it's the agriculture, it's the human interactions, and it's behavior. It's do you always need to take an antibiotics? So there are multiple approaches, and the stewardship. So how do you best use those antibiotics? So if we only stick on drug development, we'll have part of the equation, but we will not have the old vision of how we have to deal with resistance. So this has taught me that multiple approaches are needed, and this is why you have multidisciplinary research projects, which often there are targeted. Yes, they are. This is more top-down. Say, listen, now we have these big issues, so please come together with different approaches, different expertise to try to tackle this problem, because we believe that not one single approach will suffice.
And that convergence for those multiple goals is happening now.
Yes, I would say so.
You mentioned at the beginning that you have a busy life. What were your main or key influencers for you as a scientist?
Yeah, well, I gave two examples, but I would not even be able to. I don't remember their name. It was a teacher at college that intrigued genetics, and there was a teacher discussing about antigenic variation in the African trypanosomes. But there are a number of key individuals afterwards that really change the way I was doing. And I think the person that has probably the biggest influence in making me a researcher focusing on parasite and having an approach was my postdoc mentor. His name is Piet Borst. He's at the Netherlands Cancer Institute. It's funny because he's worked on many areas, but I think, although I'm not sure, but for me at least, it was his work on antigenic variation. But he was the scientific director of the Netherlands Cancer Institute, a center of excellence on cancer, and he was working on a cancer-related project where he's been very successful. But his peak when he took the job was antigenic variation. He said, "Mark, this is the king of gene rearrangements, and cancer is gene rearrangements. So hopefully, I'll be able to to contribute to that. But afterwards, he was working on multi-drug resistance in cancer, and he's been very successful. So yeah, he has been important So it was really a mentor, but it was also, I was looking at how he was successful. But, you know, everything I do, and this is why it's important to go at different places, there are things that I take from different places. And sometimes when I do things, I think, gee, this is, I've learned at that place. And this is what makes you different. You're not a clone of somebody else. You take what is the best, but some have a little bit more influence than others.
What is the goal that is still missing for you in your career that you would like to achieve?
So I'm I had more years behind me than in front of me as a researcher, but I still hopefully have another let's say 10 years to contribute. And I've been successful in mechanistic understanding, and I'm for the last bit, I would really like to bring a new molecule to phase one. So we have a number of interesting molecules now that we are close to human trial, at least for safety first, and then maybe efficacy if it goes fast, but that are highly active, that we understand the target, we can even modify them. But it is a long process. But if I could achieve doing this, I think that would be something that would be very proud. Although I've been very proud so far of what I've achieved. And for bacteria, well, I don't know yet, but maybe we're something very interesting with this transfer of genetic information from one bacteria to the other, and that would be more mechanistically related. But if preliminary result, well, it's very preliminary yet, but I'm very excited about it. And this is the beauty. Although I've been 30 years in the business,
I'm still excited about it.
You know, often it's incremental, and you're moderately excited about it. But when it can have the potential to be a game changer, then you're very, 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 very happy. And you're excited. And this is the beauty. Because once you stop being excited, I think maybe it's time to think about something else.
Besides knowing how to interpret data, what would be your piece of advice for a young scientist?
Yeah, I've trained many young, and I still train many young. And the first question I ask them is, why are you here? I mean, and then, you know, if it's because I like it, I want to do it, then I say, okay, that's the right reason. And it's to listen to your gut, listen to what you think is important, but also listen to advice of others, because some others have expertise and experience, but just like us as kids, we have to make our own mistakes also. Yes, this is how we grow up as human, as adult, and it's through mistakes that you're gonna have, because if everything is easy, you'll never learn. And at one point when it matters, then it will be. But listen to others, like, and even as kids, you listen to your parent. Sometimes you may not do it exactly the way they want it, but you listen to them, because it will come back. So you have to show this drive, of wanting to, you know, to explore by yourself, but also you have to listen to others. And it is fun. It is fun to do research. I mean, but it's not easy. Yes, so it's not for everybody, because when you're studying, you're the master of the world, you're the master of your success or insuccess, because you're the one that will decide on how much. When you're doing research, yes, you're the one that decides how hard you're going to work, but you're not the one who decides about the end results. Because it's a matter of many, many things. It's the matter of their starting working hypothesis. It's a matter not only of how smart you are, but also how gifted you are with your hands, because some experiments are more involved than others. it matters about the material you start with. So people that have been living with success after study sometimes are a little baffled by the insuccess in the lab. But don't be discouraged. I mean, just think about what were the critical steps so that you can arrive to, you know, an hypothesis and then a result that either confirm or infirm, then it's fine. I mean, at one point you want confirmation at one point of some of the ideas, but that it's a clear result. Yes? So A supposed to arrive at B. Do I arrive at B or not? But is it clear? There's no more dispute. It's B or it's something else, but it cannot be B. And then you have to move on. But passion and hard work.
And hard work.
Hard work is needed. Are the keys to at least have a nice, fun career. And read a lot. Read a lot because there's a lot of clever people that put hypotheses that make proposals that often can help you in your own project of how to move forward.
Okay, thank you so much for your time and for the answer, interesting answers.
Para ouvir mais, subscreva os podcasts da Universidade do Porto em noticias.up.pt.